Well, hello and welcome to The Mariner with me, Chris Stemmel-Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. We're on the second book, 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on chapter 12, and this is the 11th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner. And there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 12. A Genuine Fortune Teller. I set sail early in the morning of February the 10th, 1902, and with a fresh southerly breeze sailed through the harbour of Newcastle toward Knobby Head Lighthouse. After rounding the head, my course was south, but the wind being from the southward, I put her about 75 miles off the land and took advantage of the Australian stream, which was quite a help to me. The quick motion of the tillicum was too much for my new mate's stomach, and he soon hung his head over the rail. I advised him to take a good drink of salt water, and he would soon be all right, but somehow he could not get the salt water down, and kept sick day after day, being therefore of very little use. The wind remained in the south day after day, at times varying a little to the east or west, of which I took advantage in tacking about, and between that and the southerly current, I gradually worked my way down as far as Cape Howe, the southeast point of Australia, where I had to alter my course to the southwestward for Bass Straits. But as bad luck would have it, not alone did the wind haul into the southwest, but it started to blow a heavy gale, which lasted nearly 2 days, during which time we were hove to under a sea anchor and drifted a long way out of our course. That gale almost killed my mate. In my long career at sea, I have found that, as a rule, if a person gets seasick and takes a good drink or two of salt water, he soon gets over it. But my new mate was unable to swallow it at all, and as seawater is the only remedy I know of that does any good, I had to give him up as a bad job. I may say that nearly all through my voyage I took a drink of seawater every morning. That is about the only medicine I used, with a few exceptions, which I will explain later on, and I was nearly always in excellent health. After the southwesterly gale, I was lucky in getting a leading all-sail breeze and soon got up to the west of Bass Straits, after which the wind hauled into the southwest again and increased fast with threatening weather, so I was practically sure of another gale. It was 14 days since I had sailed from Newcastle. My mate had been sick all the time, and I was afraid that if we should get into another southwesterly gale, it might kill him. My position at that time was a little to the southeast of Cape Liptrap, and according to a chart of the coast which I had there, there was a good-sized lagoon at the head of Liptrap Bay, about 20 miles distant in a northerly direction, to which there is an entrance for small vessels. As I had a strong southwesterly wind, I kept off and steered for the lagoon. The wind was increasing fast, and in about 3 hours' time I could see the entrance, and sometimes when my little vessel was on top of a sea, the smooth water in the lagoon. But at that same time I saw heavy surf breakers both before the entrance and also along the shore as far as the eye could reach. I realised at once that I had got into a very dangerous position, and could not think of allowing the boat to get into the breakers ahead of me, and as the place where I was formed a kind of horseshoe bight, with a strong wind and large sea making straight into it for the land, I hauled up to the wind at once and tried to beat back out into the open sea again. I made tack for tack, but as the wind was increasing and the sea growing larger, I was obliged to shorten sail. Nevertheless, instead of beating to the seaward, I drew ever nearer to the breakers, and thereby knew that it was impossible to keep clear of them. I therefore prepared to sail the tillicum through the heavy breaking water. I asked my mate if he was a good swimmer. He said that he was, but in the condition he was in at the time would last but a very short while in the breakers. I had 2 small life belts and put one round my mate, advising him, if a breaker should turn the boat over, to be careful not to get underneath, but to get away from the boat as quickly as possible, and then take his time in swimming ashore, as a life belt would keep his head up out of the water, and to let all the breakers pass over him. I then donned the other, and swung the tillicum round before the wind and sea, and steered straight in for the breakers under small sails. I also put my sea anchor over the stern with one line fastened to the mouth and the other to the point of it, and as I was sailing towards the breakers, towed it along by the line which was fastened to the point. The sea anchor being light, it slipped over the surface of the water without retarding the speed of the boat. In a minute or two, we were in the midst of the surf. When I saw the first breaker overtaking the boat, and when it was within a short distance of the stern, I slackened the tripping line. As the line that was fastened at one end of the mouth of the sea anchor and the other to the stern of the boat tightened, the sea anchor at once filled with water and stopped the headway of the vessel. The breakers would rush at us, but owing to the headway of the boat being stopped, she would raise her stern to them splendidly and only taking a little spray over. When the stern of the boat was on top of the breaker, the rudder was out of the water and therefore of no use, but the sea anchor took its place. It did not only prevent the boat from going ahead and at the same time relieved her from suction by allowing the stern to arise when on top of a breaker, but it also kept the boat from broaching to while the rudder was out of action. As soon as the breaker got under the middle of the boat and her stern dipped, the rudder took action in the water again. The boat being thus out of danger, I quickly pulled the tripping line, which turned the sea anchor over, point towards the boat. Thus we gathered headway again. I repeated the same manoeuvre with every breaker, and we crossed the surf with a minimum of trouble and taking over only a little spray. The long beach was slowly shallowing, and before the Tillicum struck bottom, we entered smooth water. When nearly halfway through the entrance, we grounded, and owing to low water, were obliged to remain there until the tide came in again. In a little while, the water had left us high and dry, and after we had taken a run on the sandy beach, my mate enjoyed a good meal for the first time in a fortnight. We had hardly finished our dinner when the tide returned and the water rose very fast. The wind blew hard also, and the water became choppy round the boat. As it rose, the waves grew larger, and before the boat was afloat, they developed into small but swiftly breaking seas which set the Tillicum rolling about on her keel. This stirred up the sand, and as the tide came running in fast and the seas rolled the boat about, she gradually swung sideways onto the wind and sea. Presently the sand began piling up on the lee side, and the water rising, the breakers grew larger and larger. However, as the boat was lying sideways, thrust up against a sandbank which increased in height faster than the tide owing to drift sand in the current, we were absolutely helpless. It was a most difficult position. The breakers would deliberately roll along and strike the boat on the starboard, hammering it sideways up against the sandbank, and at the same time sweeping over us. All we could do was to hold on, to prevent our being washed overboard. While in that awful predicament, thinking whether it would be advisable to give up the Tillicum, the Sydney fortune teller's prognostication came back to me. At that critical moment, I noticed four men running down the beach in our direction, but they could get only within about 200 yards of us. There they stood. We could not hear their voices, but saw them waving their hats as if to invite us to leave our doomed vessel and come on shore. I said to my mate, "You go ashore before the water gets too deep and save your life. I'm going to stay with the boat till she breaks up." "I will leave her when you do," my mate turned round and replied. Then, as a last resort, I hoisted the forestaysail and next the foresail, and when I hauled the foresheet in, put the boat almost on her beam ends. Just then a large breaking sea struck the boat with such a force that I thought it would dash her to pieces. But, contrary to my expectations, our boat was lifted, and the sails catching enough wind to put her over the sandbank, the Tillicum was safe and sound, once more in smooth water and out of all danger. Sailing onto the beach where the four men who had been watching our struggle for some time were waiting to receive us, I jumped ashore and introduced myself. I then learned that the gap which we had passed through into the lagoon and where we had encountered all the trouble was not the proper entrance. It was simply an opening in the narrow, low spit of land that framed the lagoon seawards. Large breaking seas during a heavily southwesterly gale had done this damage. The proper entrance lay a few miles more to the eastward. We were congratulated upon our luck in successfully effecting a landing through that false entrance. On telling them what kind of trip we were on, they said that they had read about the cruise in the Melbourne papers, but never expected me to call at this remote place. However, we received a friendly welcome and were invited to their home, which they said lay about 4 miles distant. It was also the nearest house to the spot, and we gladly accepted the invitation. After changing our clothes and assuring ourselves that the tillicum was well secured, we accompanied our newly found friends up the beach towards a forest where 4 saddle horses were hitched to a tree. My mate and myself were given a mount, and in company of 2 of our hosts, rode for about 2 miles through the forest. Passing for a like distance over a stretch of grassland, we finally arrived at a neat farmstead which belonged to the 2 gentlemen who had guided us. They were brothers, named Pinkerton. Within a very short time of our arrival, the table was spread with a sumptuous repast. After 2 weeks of fasting, my mate, who had been compelled to part even with his last meal when the boat was bumping and rolling on the sandbar, certainly did full justice to the good things before him, and remarked at the conclusion of the meal that he felt as well as ever. After dinner, the farmers entertained us with songs and music. Hearing Life on the Ocean Wave, When Ireland Will Have Home Rule, and Jig Jig with the Flap Flap certainly made us feel that we were among friends and welcome. When I hinted at 9 o'clock that it was almost time for us to return to the boat, these kind people almost compelled us to stop for the night, and even went so far as to ask us to stay for a week or two. They offered us the use of their house and buggy for as long as we liked. We thanked them for their hospitality, but gave them to understand that we had to go down to look after our boat. We promised, however, to come back the next day. When we bade them good night and opened the door, we saw to our surprise 3 horses saddled and ready to take us down to the beach. I mounted one, my mate another, and one of the farmers got astride the 3rd one. Being a poor horseman, I requested the farmer to take his time, and in the clear starlit night, we rode slowly over the pasture land. In about 30 minutes, we had reached the forest. The sky had become cloudy and overcast, so it was very dark under the trees. However, we made our way. I was just thinking how it would suit me to take a little more practice on horseback, and that I might eventually develop into a fairly good jockey and strike a job in Melbourne to ride one of the fast horses in the cup race. Possibly this mind-wandering caused me to be less careful, for somehow my horse had got off the cow trail, which we were following along between the trees, and I was suddenly brought to my senses, only to lose them temporarily by falling heavily from my mount and nearly breaking my neck. A stout bough had caught me in the chest. I lay on the ground for a few minutes, not unconscious, but thinking again of a certain fortune teller. On convincing my companions that I was unhurt, I proclaimed that I would prefer walking the rest of the way. Thereupon, as my mate swore that, while he was not much of a sailor, he could, on the other hand, navigate through any forest in the southern part of Australia, our host returned to his farm with the 3 horses. So with my mate in the lead, we resumed the cow trail, which was to take us down to the beach. We chatted as we went along through the forest, and, owing to the darkness, made only slow progress. Some considerable time had elapsed, and my dead reckoning was up. So I ventured the opinion that we should be near the boat, and I hoped we had not got on the wrong trail. My mate assured me that we were on the right course towards the boat, and that we would soon drop anchor there. We therefore continued, but when I consulted my watch and discovered that over an hour had elapsed since we had left the horses, I was quite sure that we had passed the place or got off the right trail. Now and then, through an opening in the dense foliage overhead, I could see the stars, which were gradually disappearing behind a bank of heavy clouds, and it looked to me like approaching rain. "Back the main yard and take a sounding. I should like to find out where we are," I said as I struck a match to have a look at the trail. "Well, this doesn't look to me like a cow trail. At any rate, it's not the one we came along this afternoon, which showed bare ground, worn by the tracks of cattle. This place rather resembles a pasture lately grazed over." "Indeed," my mate assented, "you are right, but just follow me and we will soon be on the cow trail again." By this time the stars had altogether disappeared and rain began to fall. We went along as best we could, my mate making full speed ahead, and owing to the darkness I lost sight of him, but as he unceasingly talked about his former bush travels in Australia, I managed to keep track of him by following his voice. All of a sudden my pilot gave an abrupt yell and called for help. I hurried to his rescue and, after striking a match, found him lying in what we called a prickle bush. In my endeavours to free him from the rank undergrowth in which he was entangled, I received my share of the prickling. When I got him out of this unenviable position, we started on our homeward journey again, this time for the most part on our hands and knees, feeling for the cow trail, which we were still unable to find. The rain was increasing fast and soon poured down on us in torrents, and as it was so dark in the forest that we could not see a hand before our eyes, we were compelled to give up our journey and stop where we happened to be to wait for the daylight. It was about 11 o'clock when we hove to in the heavy rain, which poured down on us for about 5 hours. We could not sit or lie down as the ground was flooded with water, and as it was not advisable to walk about, lest we should run into another tree or prickle bush, we had to stand like two statues. I did not say much during that time, my mind being occupied with Luxton's fortune teller, in whose ability I gradually gained confidence. We certainly felt gratified when the rain ceased at daybreak. As luck would have it, we were near the lagoon, and through the trees could see the water shimmering. A few minutes' walk brought us to the beach, where the Tillicum lay high and dry on the sand, and she had drifted up on the very high tide during the night. In about 10 minutes we were on board, and after having changed our clothes, built a large fire of driftwood to dry out our wet garments and cook breakfast. It was a beautiful morning, clear and warm, and we soon forgot our unpleasant experiences of the previous night. At 9 o'clock, 2 saddle horses were sent down by the brothers Pinkerton, on which we rode back to the farm. During our stay, the good fellows treated us so well that I almost felt homesick when we finally sailed for Melbourne, after having enjoyed their hospitality for a whole week. On the day fixed for our departure, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was high water, and we tried to get under way before that time in order to cross the surf on the top of the tide, but owing to the farewell dinner with which we were honoured by our hosts, we did not make a start until 2 hours later, and as the surf was breaking heavily outside the new entrance, I made up my mind to pass it and leave the lagoon by the proper outlet, where, as the Pinkertons had told us, we would have no difficulty in reaching the open sea. A light breeze blew out of the lagoon, which afforded us a beam wind to sail to the eastward. But when abreast of the new entrance, which I remembered so dearly, the ebb tide went rushing through it with such a force that the Tillicum was drawn towards the treacherous gap at a rate of about 6 miles an hour. Face to face once more with the dangerous breakers which came rolling towards us, and knowing that in another 5 minutes we would be right in the midst of them, if we did not succeed in stopping the boat, I dropped the anchor and lowered the sails. The boat swung round, but the anchor did not take hold. So as the boat kept on drifting, I pulled the anchor on board, swung the boat before the wind, and with the light easterly breeze sailed straight into the roaring combers. I knew that between the wind and tide the boat would have headway enough to resist the breaker's fury and prevent her being turned end over end. And then it came, and in a minute we were in it. The first few breakers were small and only threw some spray over us, but now a large one towered above us, and in an instant the Tillicum and her crew were submerged. When the sea had passed over us, I just had time enough to ascertain that the boat was all right, and no sooner had I announced another coma when it was on us with all its might. But as before, we stood the trial and got out safely, and after that we met with quite a few small breakers which, however, were not of a dangerous description, and as tide and a light northerly breeze took the boat in charge, we soon passed beyond all breaking water and entered the open sea. In crossing the breakers, no harm was done to the boat, but we obtained another good soaking, and my mate turned seasick again, this time worse than ever. By 4 o'clock, the farewell dinner, which he had enjoyed heartily, was overboard, and he still retched, his head hanging low over the rail. The wind freshened up a little towards evening, and about 8 o'clock we rounded Cape Liptrap, whence we shaped a course for the entrance of Port Phillip Bay, reaching the same on the following night at about 10 o'clock. But owing to a rumbling sound, apparently caused by the strong tide setting through the narrow entrance and thus forming a dangerous overfall, we kept off a little until the noise ceased. Then we sailed into the entrance and with a moderate southerly breeze made towards Melbourne, a distance of about 37 miles, dropping anchor off St Kilda at 5 o'clock the following afternoon. The next day, Tillicum was taken out of the water at Captain Caney's bathing establishment, and a few days later she was transported on wheels to Collins Street and exhibited there until Labour Day. She was then removed to the park and placed in the Melbourne Exhibition Building during the celebration, and at the conclusion of the latter, she was taken out of the building to be transferred by the same wagon that had previously served for conveyance. I had contracted with a truck and dray company for transporting the Tillicum wherever I wanted her. After removal from the Exhibition Building and when ready to be put on the wagon, the same shear legs that previously had lowered her were used to raise her again. These were placed in position, and two double-block tackles rove off with a 3-inch rope. The top block was hooked onto the top of the shear legs and the lower block to a strop which ran around the boat. Then the hauling part of the tackle was passed to a winch, which itself was fastened to the lower end of the shear legs. As I directed the work myself, I told the four men in attendance to heave away slowly. The Tillicum soon swung in the air, high enough to push the wagon underneath. But just when I said, "Stop heaving," the boat dropped to the ground. As I stood right alongside, she nearly fell upon me. And there she lay at my feet, smashed to pieces, after having successfully weathered all sorts of heavy gales and having carried me many thousands of miles across the ocean. She had withstood all the tumbling about at the lagoon entrance near Cape Liptrap and the tremendous breakers at that unlucky place. Now, on this bright morning, she lay there a total wreck to all appearance, wrecked on dry land and in one of the finest places in Australia, surrounded by all the products of a refined civilization, not to mention beautiful flowers and sweet singing birds. Up to that time, the Tillicum, from her keel to the top, was a solid vessel, not a seam nor a split in her hull anywhere. After the smash-up, when I examined her, I found splits in five different places, one crack extending from the top and down the middle of the stern, and along the bottom nearly as far as the forward end, and four more cracks, two on each side, running from aft to forward to about the same length. Besides, there were several cross splits. Some of the splits were from 1 inch to 2 inches wide. In fact, the boat was all in pieces. In face of this calamity, I arrived at the conclusion that I should have listened to Mr. Luxton and his fortune teller when they advised me to leave the Queen City of the South out of my programme. The breaking of the hook which held the top tackle caused the accident. The hook had snapped like a piece of glass, and as it dropped into the cockpit, I picked it up and put it in my pocket. After having re-examined my little vessel carefully, I thought that I might be able to repair her and perhaps proceed with my voyage. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.